From KCRW, this is Left, Right, and Center.
The government shut down again and then reopened again hours later. This time it may stay open for good because a bipartisan agreement sets spending levels for the next 2 years. But one key fix hasn't gotten done, a permanent solution for participants in the DACA program. Top White House aide Rob Porter quit after both of his ex-wives accused him of having abused them. His White House colleagues knew of the accusations for months because they were preventing Porter from getting a security clearance. Why was he kept on in handling sensitive information for so long? Welcome to Left, Right, and Center, your civilized yet provocative antidote to the self-contained opinion bubbles that dominate political debate. I'm Josh Barrow. Later in the show, economist Jason Furman of Harvard's Kennedy School joins us to discuss the president's frustration with the falling stock market. Who's to blame? And Christopher Green of the International Crisis Group talks to me about sports diplomacy on the Korean Peninsula. All that plus Amazon HQ2 is coming up on Left, Right, and Center. We'll be right back. Welcome back to Left, Right, and Center. I'm Josh Barrow, your center and senior editor at Business Insider. On the right is Megan McArdle, columnist at Bloomberg View. On the left is Katrina Vandenhoevel, editor and publisher of The Nation magazine. There was a government shutdown this week, but you probably slept through most of it. It started with bipartisanship. Republican Senate leader Mitch McConnell and Democratic leader Chuck Schumer reached a bipartisan agreement on 2 years of federal spending levels. The deal gives Republicans a substantial increase in military spending and Democrats a nearly as substantial increase in domestic spending on programs from broadband to the National Institutes of Health. The deal also provides funding for relief from recent natural disasters. Kentucky Senator Rand Paul did not like the deal at all, and he tied up business so the Senate couldn't pass it until 1 in the morning Friday. Over in the House, Nancy Pelosi had taken to the floor for 8 hours on Thursday to express her strong opposition to the agreement, on the grounds that it did not provide a fix for the Deferred Action for Childhood Arrivals program, or DACA. But Pelosi sent mixed messages about how much she was expecting her Democratic colleagues to join her in opposition, and just over 70 Democrats voted against her, joining Paul Ryan and Chuck Schumer and Donald Trump in favor of the deal. This allowed the funding bill to pass the House early in the morning and allowed the government to reopen by 9 a.m. on Friday. Katrina, I think a lot of people have been confused by what happened in the House, including some Democratic members of the House. What happened here?
I think there is a division within the Democratic Party and the Democratic caucus. Let's be honest, the Democrats don't have power. I think for many Democrats, they saw in this bill important priorities were addressed, right? From opioid funding to funding for community health centers. But there is a fundamental betrayal of dreamers. And for, you know, a large number of Democrats, that is a betrayal. And I think there will be movement to lay this at the feet of Paul Ryan, the current failure to bring a dreamer bill to the floor, lay that at the feet of Paul Ryan. He's implied, Ryan, that he'll tackle this issue immediately. It's, I think, the job of many of the Democrats who voted against and all of the Democrats to hold him and the Republican majority accountable to that. But there is division. I mean, look at Nancy Pelosi. What she tried to do was a moral stance, the DACA filibuster, so to speak. But without the power and with division in the Democratic caucus, fearful, I think, of being accused by a Republican Party, which has betrayed the Dreamers. I mean, what Trump said he would do, he didn't do. But there's fear that it would be a messaging failure to say, you know, look, Democrats are holding up a budget bill where there is some good budgeting for issues Democrats care about because of immigration.
Megan, do you agree with what I think is Katrina's implication here, which is that if the Democrats had played their cards differently here, they could have forced some sort of concession on DACA out of the Republicans?
No. I think that the issue is fundamentally Democrats are in a really weak negotiating position on DACA in the same way that, you know, Republicans in 2011, 2013 were in a really weak negotiating position on Obamacare, and for the same reason, which is that if nothing happens, if nothing is done, then in, you know, one case, Democrats who wanted Obamacare to keep going get what they want. And in another, a Republican restrictionists get what they want. And given that, right, Democrats are going to have to come to the table and make actual concessions on immigration. And this kind of hope that there is some way that we'll just take care of the Dreamers, taking a major bargaining chip off the table for the Republican restrictionists, and then we'll go negotiate immigration. It's just not realistic. And I think, you know, it's a little frightening how thoroughly the base seems to have embraced the idea that there is some way to get what they want on immigration without giving any concessions to Republicans.
I don't agree with that. I think that there is support within the Democratic Party for a, quote, kind of bipartisan deal where you would have the Dreamers, you would, in a continuation of Obama policy, put up some money for security, whether you call it the wall or not. But there's real fight on the family migration issue and a fight on the visa. And I think what's happened is Trump administration and hawkish Republicans are insistent now putting all of that in. And Trump, you know, has sabotaged the bipartisan agreement several times. So let me just say one thing, though, that's striking. It's not new. It's not novel. But, you know, I think some deficits are good deficits. But the deficit hypocrisy here is so blatant, particularly, you know, Senator Rand Paul, whose opposition to endless war and against surveillance I respect. But, you know, this fight in him, I can't in all good honesty and all good faith just look the other way because my party's now complicit in the deficits. Well, he voted for a tax bill, right, which led to a $1.5 trillion increase in the deficit, along with all of his Republican colleagues. This isn't new to you, Megan. I mean, you've seen it with George W. Cheney telling the reporter, you know, deficits don't matter, right? And didn't Paul O'Neill, Treasury Secretary in the Bush administration, all of that. So where that heads, I think there will be insurrection inside the Republican Party as a result of this, but it's not clear where it's channeled at the moment.
I actually think Rand Paul is one of the few people who has been consistent on the spending issue.
But he voted for the tax. I mean, he voted for the tax bill.
Because what Rand Paul hates isn't government budget deficits. What he hates is government spending. He wants a smaller government, and I think he voted for the tax cut.
Because of that.
In part because he wanted people to keep more of their money, and in part because he thought it would create pressure to cut government spending in the future. And obviously that hasn't worked because Republicans came here and cut this deal that increases government spending both on defense and non-defense matters. I think it's the rest of or most of the rest of the Republican caucus that has been inconsistent because they said government's too big. We need to cut spending. The tax cut is OK because, you know, something it'll grow the economy in the future and we'll cut spending in the future. Then they come back and vote for the spending increase. At least Rand Paul was consistent in opposing the spending increase and saying, no, his end game is a smaller government than a larger one.
I think this shows you something that, you know, William Niskanen, formerly late of the Cato Center, used to say that there had been this theory that was going around Republican libertarian circles in the 80s called starve the beast, right? Which is that you cut taxes and then that puts pressure on spending. What Niskanen said was like starve the beast clearly failed. And in fact, it looks like deficits actually allow spending to grow because people don't have to have any suffering. You can just put new spending in and no one has to think about the cost. But I would point out about Bush, you know, in 2007, the Bush budget deficit was 1.6% of GDP, which is certainly lower than Obama got by a lot. Even after the economy had recovered. And in fact, like in the Bush administration, for all that I was not in favor of deficit spending and so forth, that in fact, they ended up looking, with the exception of the financial crisis, which is also what derailed a lot of Obama's budgets, not all of them by any means, but some, with the exception of that, where I think most people, including me, would agree that deficit spending was warranted and of some sort, they actually were pretty fiscally responsible. They went up slightly in a recession, but ultimately they didn't actually blow the budget deficit. That you have, I think, can and should lay at the feet of Trump and the current crop of Republican congressmen.
Well, he's a debt king. He's king of debt. But I do think, listen, there are good deficits. The problem at the moment is it's not clear you need this infusion of money in the system at this time. And we'll talk about that with the market and what's happening. But you got runaway defense spending, which could be invested in real needs. I'm for deficits if they're investing in the real needs, education, infrastructure of this country. But what we're witnessing here is something very different. And I think it's crazy when you think that the fiscal year 2017 appropriations for defense exceeded the military spending of the next eight largest spenders combined, six of which are U.S. allies that were pouring more money. And by the way, Democrats voted for more money for the defense appropriation. Starve the beast has also starved this country of essential investment and needs. And we're going to see more of that because we've talked about it here, but you know, as you see deficits, and you know, someone like Paul Ryan's going to turn around, or whoever his replacement is, and say, hey, we need to cut Medicare, Medicaid, Social Security. Those are
maybe, but that doesn't seem
politically, maybe not, but there will be a move on among some, quote, principled.
Right. But it's never, there's never going to be a great political moment for Medicare and Social Security cuts. So, I mean, you saw this playing out this year, where Paul Ryan wanted to use this year's budget process to do what they were going to call entitlement reform, some kind of right. entitlement cuts. And Mitch McConnell basically just said, no, I don't feel like doing that. I mean, it was going to be politically challenging for a lot of Republican senators seeking reelection. It was going to be difficult to get 50 Republican votes for any particular package on that. And so, but I think, you know, that's not unique about this time. In general, I think one thing that Donald Trump understands that Ronald Reagan understood was that tax cuts are a lot more popular than spending cuts. And Ronald Reagan, even though he has this reputation as this anti-government crusader, basically made peace with the welfare state,
absolutely.
Left it in more or less the same condition as when he arrived in the presidency. And I think Donald Trump gets that there was never a big market for those sorts of cuts.
But the Republican Party, the Ryan wing.
Here's the problem is that, in fact, you know, Ronald Reagan could do that. We are now hard on the baby boomer bulge starting to move through the system. Now, I speak as someone who dislikes deficits except in kind of extraordinary circumstances. You know, World War II, fine. Great Depression, financial crisis, fine. In general, I really don't like deficits, and I don't like them if they're Republican deficits or Democratic deficits. And so I think if you look at, you know, is this going to create pressure to cut Social Security and Medicaid? No, but we're going to have that pressure anyway. We are now we're now only like 15 years from the Social Security Trust Fund running out of money and benefits statutorily getting cut by 25%, which is something that people—
Social Security cap. There are all kinds of reforms. But you hear, Josh, to
raise
be honest,
the cap
you hear from
is not
Megan
a small thing.
What
raise
is going to be discussed.
Raise the cap is a 12% income tax surtax on all income above $100,000 a year. That's a huge tax increase. That's not like a little, all you have to do is raise the tax.
Well, but I mean, I think, you know, the point is broadly, we've been through this 20-year period, and we'll discuss this with Jason Furman later in the show, where the borrowing capacity of the government has been essentially unlimited, where you haven't seen big feedback in rising interest rates. And so long as that persists, there's been this ability to just borrow more. You don't have to raise the tax cap. You can just move money from general revenue or from borrowing into Social Security if you wish. And then, you know, that works until it doesn't work, and it could conceivably work for a very long time. I do, before we get away from this, I want to get back actually to the caps matter itself, because basically the way we got into this position where you had these low caps on defense spending and non-defense discretionary spending, which is a wide variety of domestic functions, was out of the Budget Control Act 7 years ago. There was this agreement to put those caps in. It was supposed to be a placeholder for some sort of entitlement reform or tax increases, which never got done. And so this was basically an accidental policy. And you've seen criticism from both the right and the left of what this has meant for the actual delivery of government services, including the military. And so one of the big things that we get out of this deal is we have 2 years of spending certainty at a higher level, but also at a clear level, so that government agencies can do planning. And I guess, you know, we talk about government spending as big numbers and the effects on the economy of how much we borrow for it. But I guess a key question about this deal is, do we feel good about the way that it actually spends money? What it's going to, the services it's going to deliver?
I mean, I believe that federal spending on education, healthcare, clean energy, for example, creates more jobs than Pentagon spending does. And the Pentagon budget is already at historic highs. It's rife with waste and abuse. Speaking crudely, I think the primary beneficiaries of more Pentagon spending will be defense industry executives. So I think, though there's been now this, at least you had the raising of caps on the non-discretionary domestic side, but not at the equivalent level. And I think it's wasteful. It's wasteful, and it doesn't provide for a reorientation of smart investment.
Megan, do you think we're going to get useful things out of this spending?
I honestly think that the government did not need to raise the spending caps. And again, I'm a deficit hawk, as these things go. And so, you know, we shouldn't have done a tax cut that wasn't financed. We definitely, having done that tax cut, should not be raising the deficit further by raising spending caps. What we should be doing is looking for a way, when in an expansion, as we are now, to live within our means. We shouldn't be borrowing money that we, when we have all of these fiscal problems coming down the pike from Social Security and Medicare and Medicaid. These are giant issues that we have still failed to resolve. We've got Social Security disability as well is going to need to be refinanced. And none of these problems have been solved. We should fix the spending problems we have now before we start doing new spending.
We're going to take a break. I'll be back with Megan McArdle, columnist at Bloomberg View, and Katrina Vandenhoevel of The Nation magazine to talk about domestic violence allegations against a White House staffer. You're listening to Left, Right, and Center.
What do you think? Share your thoughts on today's show on our Facebook page or tweet us at LRCKCRW. And download the KCRW app to listen to Left, Right, and Center on demand.
Back again with Left, Right, and Center. I'm Josh Barrow of Business Insider and MSNBC. On the left is Katrina Vandenhoevel, editor and publisher of The Nation magazine. On the right is Megan McArdle, columnist at Bloomberg View. White House Deputy Press Secretary Rod Shaw did something highly unusual this week. He admitted the White House handled something badly. "We all could have done better," he said, of the White House response to news that Staff Secretary Rob Porter, a top aide under Chief of Staff John Kelly, was accused of abusing both of his ex-wives. One ex-wife produced a photo of herself with a black eye she says Porter gave her while on vacation. The other obtained an emergency protective order against Porter after he broke a window trying to enter her home while they were separated. Porter has denied the allegations. At first, the White House strongly defended Porter. Kelly issued an effusive statement calling Porter a man of integrity. Kelly and others had tried to talk Porter out of resigning. But on Thursday, Porter was gone, terminated, according to Shaw, although they later revised the story again to say he had resigned. On Friday, President Trump called the departure sad and pointed to Porter's claim that he's innocent. Porter had been unable to get a security clearance because of the abuse allegations. But that didn't stop the White House from keeping him on in a role where he handled highly classified information for over a year. This story is alarming on several levels.
It is alarming. I mean, it's alarming to me. I mean, it's alarming in terms of how this White House, it's time to talk about this White House, whether they value women consistently. Their actions tell us they don't. I think it's also broader, obviously, than Porter. I would say the credibility of John Kelly, the chief of staff, is under real siege. I mean, to have a chief of staff defend the integrity of a person who's been credibly accused of being a wife beater is stunning, unconscionable. Then you learn that so many don't have security clearances in this White House. What's going on with that? But I think this, you know, that this White House, key people in the White House were fine with an alleged domestic abuser working next to the Oval Office, as long as the press and the public didn't know, says something about the integrity, the ethics of this White House.
Yeah, Megan, this is a remarkable thing. I mean, Kelly had been aware for some time of these allegations, and White House counsel Don McGahn apparently had been aware of them for a year.
Yes. You know, I think there is a, if it had been one allegation, right. I mean, the fact is that if you talk to a divorce attorney, you will hear that in divorce cases, people do make really wrong allegations. They're very angry about the dissolution of a relationship, and they say things that aren't true. And so I think if it had been one, you could write this off to, well, you know, maybe it's just his ex-wife who's very angry at something else and has inserted an allegation into the divorce proceedings and is now trying to kind of get back at him with the FBI. When it gets to two, you start to say, no, that's not really a credible. What are the odds that two of his ex-wives, or I guess both of them, there were not, as far as I know, anymore. What are the odds that both of them independently came up with the same scurrilous accusation to get back at him? And then you say, and also, how do you have two ex-wives by the age of 40? You start to say, well, okay, this is not someone we should have around. Even if you don't think it's wrong, and you're wrong about that, but even if you don't, how do you not understand this is going to come out? The odds that, I mean, you know, this is, you know, those women could go to the newspapers at any time, as they eventually did. And then you're going to have to explain why you kept a wife beater around. I don't understand how this happened, except that it's a chaotic place and people aren't thinking straight.
Chaotic. I mean, the White House press office and Kelly ignored credible allegations against Porter until the very end. I mean, Kelly was calling him a man of honor until recently. And Wednesday night he was doing that. And then he was shocked. And then he had to move. It shows that there's a kind of a lockdown in this White House, an arrogance, an imperviousness to scrutiny. It's interesting because we've talked on this program. I mean, Kelly's luster has been eroded over these last months, whether because of proximity to Trump and what this White House, the sort of metastasizing integrity corruption problems. Or, you know, he's someone, I think Maggie Haberman and another reporter at the Times Today reported that Kelly has previously appeared as a character witness in a 2016 court-martial of a Marine colonel accused of sexually harassing two female subordinates. Turns out this Marine officer, superb Marine officer Kelly called him, there was allegations of child sexual harassment. Yeah, I mean, it's pretty disturbing.
One thing that's been amazing to me about this Porter case is that not just turning a blind eye before it was public, but the initial defense afterward. And I think part of it is it's a chaotic White House. Porter was supposed to be one of the people who was bringing order to the chaotic White House. He had a good reputation. I actually knew Rob Porter a little bit when we were in college together, and he seemed like a total Boy Scout, which is consistent with the public descriptions, including by his first ex-wife, who describes how she had no inkling of this behavior until after they had gotten married, and then there was this change. So I think it was the allegations were contrary to people's image of him at work, but then the amount of deference that they gave him because he was seen as essential to the operation, and you still had Senator Orrin Hatch, who he used to work for as chief of staff, out defending him and saying that the accusations were politically motivated this week. It's a window into something quite bad. The people who were supposed to have relatively good judgment in this room have decided that he was so important that they were willing to accept this behavior. And I think part of it is, you know, Trump has surrounded himself with people of low character. In part, there's been this sense that, you know, that other people have been too soft, and that Trump's projection of his own bad character was seen by a lot of voters and by a lot of his supporters as a projection of strength, that ethics and good moral behavior are for suckers, and that you demonstrate how strong you are.
Pugilistic kind of politics of domination, matrix. I mean, that's what Josh Marshall's written about, just kind of how Trump wants to dominate everyone. And that does feed your surround and those who work for you.
I don't think that this is somehow unique to the White House. Let's look at how many people defended Bill Clinton right up to the point where his wife lost an election and then they didn't need to anymore. And then suddenly they all had an epiphany at once that this had been really bad behavior. In fact, you know, defending things, keeping people around who have done things that you recognize are wrong, that's kind of normal political behavior. That doesn't excuse it, by the way. I am not in any way excusing allowing this man to stay on staff and coming out and defending him. But this is not as if the Trump White House just invented this tactic. The Democrats really perfected it under the Clintons.
Let's turn to some more uplifting news. The 23rd Winter Olympics began this week in Pyeongchang, South Korea, and they seem to be coinciding with somewhat more positive relations between the two Koreas. Christopher Green is a senior advisor with the International Crisis Group and an expert on the Korean Peninsula. I spoke with him earlier about the history of sports diplomacy in Korea and how these Olympics might or might not change the course of relations.
I think the odds are that it'll be back to the normal level of tension within, if not 3 weeks, then certainly not much longer than that. Regression to the mean has always been the motif of previous sports diplomacy on the Korean Peninsula. But on the flip side, you never know, and it does depend how the various parties play it from here as to what will be happening in a month or two.
So when you say previous sports diplomacy on the Korean Peninsula, what's the track record here?
Well, sports diplomacy in Korea began in the early 1990s with a variation on the ping-pong diplomacy of the 1970s, US-China. There have been combined teams. There have been events such as Sydney and Athens Olympics, where North and South Korea competed separately but marched under the same flag. There have been lower-level combined teams in youth football, things like this, in the early 2000s for the most part. But this is the first time for 10 years that they've done anything like this. There were two pretty conservative administrations in Seoul in that interim period and the end of the Kim Jong-il regime in North Korea. So the situation simply wasn't right for it. So we'll see. But in the early 2000s, the legacy is not great, I wouldn't say.
What is North Korea's objective with sports and sports diplomacy? What do they see themselves as getting out of this Olympics and out of these sorts of international sporting events?
Well, these Olympics are specific to the Kim Jong-un regime, so the discussion has to be a bit different to what it would have been at the beginning of the 2000s. The Kim Jong-un regime benefits because it has tied Kim Jong-un's legitimacy in part, some small part, to sporting success, to the dynamism of youth, sporting activities, this kind of thing. So there's a domestic message to be had from both sending a team to South Korea and then sending all of the ancillary, the taekwondo test team, the the song and dance groups to give two concerts in Kangnung and in Seoul, all of this kind of stuff, play strongly at home. But in addition, North Korea will be hoping to maybe foster some instability in a range of relationships that are currently antagonistic against it. So what am I saying? Well, there's the ROK-US alliance, military alliance, which has been very strong for several years. There's the international consensus on sanctions, which has been reinforced by North Korea's bellicose behavior in 2016, 2017. And then there's domestic opinion in South Korea, which has always been a bit divided on how to deal with North Korea. But in the last 5 years or so, with North Korea doing a bunch of stuff, which most people in South Korea agree is completely unacceptable, it's moved in the direction of being against North Korea in general. So North Korea wants to foster a bit more instability than is currently the case in all of those relationships.
So when you say foster instability, is that basically to try to draw more opinion toward them within South Korea and therefore create more distance on the question of how hard a line to take with North Korea between the South Koreans and Japan and the U.S., which might be inclined to take a harder line?
In some sense, yes. In terms of the international sanctions regime, North Korea would like to put some holes in it, no doubt, because it's probably starting to bite, especially the kind of harsh sanctions the UN has put in place in 2017, September and December, two particularly harsh UN resolutions were put in place. But in terms of South Korea, I don't think North Korea really cares too much whether South Korea is conciliatory or sort of conservative aggressive, as long as there's division. Division leaving South Korea a little bit divided is obviously good for North Korea, because South Korea is the sort of the enemy state on the Korean Peninsula.
So why is sports the vehicle for this? Why is sort of this the way for North Korea to relate to the world and try to do these thaws?
In this case, I think it's expedience. The Winter Olympics, we knew it was coming, especially after Moon Jae-in was elected in Seoul. We knew that the South Koreans would want to promote it in the way that they have sought to do so. So this happens to be the event that came along and gave North Korea the opportunity to pull the trick, as it were, that it has pulled. It didn't have to be sport, but granted, there is a track record of this kind of thing, which made it a bit easier.
How are the Olympics experienced in North Korea? Like, what does the coverage look like? People, you know, do the games, are they covered in a manner similar that you'd see around the rest of the world?
Yes and no. I mean, North Korea has limited broadcasting space. They don't run 24-hour TV. They don't have cable TV. They don't have 500 channels on your television or anything like that. But there is an interest in things like the Olympics and the World Cup. They do have a 24-hour sports channel on the weekends now, which focuses mostly on domestic sport, but they show Champions League. They show various international sporting events too. They more often than not show them in highlights, not least because the time zone may not be right, but they also did have experiments with live sport for the World Cup in 2010 that were not an unalloyed success. Nevertheless, they do show quite a lot of sport. I mean, sport is something that a lot of North Korean people enjoy and like to watch on television where possible.
And so will they, I mean, you know, to the extent that North Korea has victories that will be known about, that's something that ends up mattering in the domestic political situation?
Oh, most certainly. If we look back to the Summer Olympics of 2012 in London, North Korea won a bunch of medals. They did very well, given their size and relative affluence as a state. When those athletes got home, everybody knew that they had won medals. They may not have known the names of the athletes. That's certainly true. But they knew that medals had been won, and those athletes were given a ticker tape parade through the streets of Pyongyang. They met the leader. They were given state honors. They had banquets and so on and so forth. So there was celebration nationwide. So that's a strong word. Pyongyang-wide celebration of those successes.
And then what do the Olympics mean for South Korea? This is the second Olympic Games in South Korea, the first Winter Olympic Games. What goals are they trying to achieve by hosting these games?
South Korea hosts international sporting events and other events of international importance, G20, things like this, to signal its emergence as an affluent country and a responsible actor on the world stage. The sporting events it's hosted, the 1988 Olympics, the 2002 World Cup, and then these Winter Olympics, have shown an incremental improvements and successes in achieving exactly that. In addition, domestically, South Korea can signal its maturity to the domestic audience and show that it is the party on the Korean Peninsula that is seeking to do well by the people. Let's put it that way.
Vice President Mike Pence has been leading the U.S. delegation to the games, and he's been taking a pretty hard line. He announced on his arrival in the region that there would be some sort of new sanctions against North Korea. He's also hinted at the idea that he might be willing to have meetings with North Korean officials, although it doesn't sound like there's anything concrete there. What do you think he's trying to achieve?
I think if we look back to the State of the Union address, President Trump was within his rights, and I think it was a good thing. that he invited a defector to be in the audience at the State of the Union. He referred to the family of Otto Warmbier, a young American who fell into a coma in North Korean custody and then died shortly after his repatriation to the United States. Those were signals of seriousness of purpose about things like North Korean human rights, completely acceptable. It's not clear to me that it's a good idea to repeat that activity by taking the family of Otto Warmbier to the Winter Olympic opening ceremony. It seems like a rather cheap political activity, and it might be better to let diplomacy have its chance and see what happens with all of those important parties to the Korean Peninsula conflict in the room in Pyeongchang at the same time.
So when you were saying that you thought that the most likely case was that things would sort of revert back to normal within a few weeks, but that you don't know and that things could change, what would you be looking for, a surprising thing that could make these games different than past examples of sports diplomacy on the Korean Peninsula?
North Korea would like nothing more than to persuade the South Korean side to try and cancel the joint military exercises that will take place at the end of the Paralympics, so the end of March, beginning of April. If South Korea were to ask to do that, then that would signal a victory for North Korea's strategy of attempting to put a wedge into the ROK-US alliance. And that would certainly lead to good relations between South and North Korea, at least in the medium term. But the reality is that's not going to happen because the South Korean government isn't likely to abrogate the alliance at this point, if ever. So I don't think we're going to see that situation emerge.
Christopher Green of the International Crisis Group, I want to thank you for joining us.
Thank you.
Still with me are on the left, Katrina Vandenhoevel of The Nation magazine, and on the right, Megan McCardle of Bloomberg View. So I've been watching Washington Post reporters who are on this trip with Vice President Mike Pence, reporting on some snafus that have been happening there, including the vice president's office put out a statement about being greeted by the Korean ambassador to the U.S., and then they realized some hours later that they had sent out the wrong name, the name of an ambassador who had actually left that post months ago. The vice president showed up at a dinner VIP reception before the Olympics, and there was nowhere for the vice president to sit because he was supposed to have dinner with U.S. athletes. And so we've been without a U.S. ambassador to South Korea for a year. And this seems like a trip where part of, you know, the vice president's ability to do U.S. diplomacy is maybe being hindered. By the way, the Trump administration has not put resources toward
diplomacy.
Well,
I mean, we talked earlier about the militarization of policy, but I think the demeaning of diplomatic engagement as part of this administration's overall policy as it engages the world is seen in what you're describing as Pence's situation. I mean, to me, what's interesting is this is really about North and South Korea, and your guest, Christopher Green, talked, the stakes are high. I mean, what's interesting about this moment is Moon has an opportunity, Moon being the president of South Korea, to convey privately to Kim Jong-un's sister the inordinate dangers and risks that North Korea will face if it presses forward with its nuclear advancement. The stakes are high, and I think there's an opportunity here to avoid confrontation and to resume a kind of diplomatic process that may be very much between the two Koreas. And I think Moon is savvy about this. He's credited Trump in a savvy way with beginning the process of renewal of resumption of discussion. But, you know, if Trump and Pence and this administration bluster and militarize the situation, you will see more and more regional diplomacy, South Korea, North Korea working together to try and denuclearize North Korea. So I think these Olympics, which Moon, by the way, branded the Peace Olympics in order to get the Olympics to South Korea, are very important in that context.
I tend to think that these things kind of come and then fade. It's hard for me to see how this is really going to ultimately move the needle that much. You know, the divisions on the Korean Peninsula go back 70 years at this point, and they are deep and wide. And I wish that, you know, the Olympics were somehow going to massively change that, but I'm skeptical.
And now it's time for Tweets of the Week. Sometimes it takes only 140 characters or maybe 280 of them to distill the spirit of the week. Katrina Vandenhoevel, what's your Tweet of the Week?
Former Washington editor of The Nation, Chris Hayes, he tweeted, "The stock market is not the economy. The stock market is not the economy. The stock market is not the economy." And like five or six more times. But you get the message. I appreciate that.
Megan McCardle, what tweet struck you?
I'm going to have a trouble pronouncing this. Niels Lisniewski of Roll Call tweeted quoting Rand Paul, "Are we to be conservative all the time or only when we're in the minority?" says Rand Paul, distilling this whole debate to a sentence. And I think sadly for fiscal conservatives everywhere, the answer is only when we're in the minority. But I wish that it were otherwise.
I was amused when President Trump got mad at the stock market on Wednesday. He tweeted, "In the old days, when good news was reported, the stock market would go up. Today, when good news is reported, the stock market goes down. Big mistake. And we have so much good, great news about the economy." As we tape on Friday, February 9, the Dow Jones has fallen about 11% from the peak it reached on January 26. And that's a good segue into our next segment. Katrina, Megan, and I will be back shortly with Harvard Kennedy School economist Jason Furman to talk about the assertion from Trump that the stock market's not giving him his due. You're listening to Left, Right, and Center.
Join the conversation on our Facebook page or tweet us at LRCKCRW. Stream all episodes of Left, Right, and Center and other great shows at kcrw.com/podcasts.
Back again with Left, Right, and Center. I'm your host, Josh Barrow. On the left is Katrina Vandenhoevel, editor and publisher of The Nation magazine. On the right is Megan McArdle, columnist at Bloomberg View. We're joined now by Jason Furman, the former chairman of President Obama's Council of Economic Advisors and now professor at the Harvard Kennedy School of Government. Welcome, Jason.
Thanks for having me.
So let's talk about that tweet from the president. Is Donald Trump right to be frustrated and to say that the stock market correction is inexplicable in light of the positive economic news we've been seeing?
I don't think you're ever in a good position if you're lecturing the market on what it should or shouldn't have done differently. If the president wanted to say, you know what, we shouldn't be looking at the stock market this much because it's not the most important test for the success of the economy. And in fact, at least part of why it's gone down recently is because of good economic news. So let's focus on good economic news and ignore the market. That would have been a perfectly good tweet.
So we've been seeing interest rates rising pretty quickly for about the last 6 weeks. And we've also had this big tax cut. We've had this budget deal, both of which grow the deficit. Should we be worrying that government borrowing is crowding out private activity, that as the government goes to borrow all that money and as the economy picks up and businesses are also more interested in investing, that that's what's driving up interest rates and is going to make it more expensive for people to get mortgages, more expensive for businesses to get capital, and ultimately mean that all these deficits hurt the economy?
Yes, I think we really should be worrying about that. I don't think our fiscal expansion is going to be able to raise output. Maybe it will a little bit this year, but not next year, because the Fed will offset it. But when the Fed offsets it, that means you end up with a different mixture with higher interest rates, lower investment, and that means less of what we really need in this economy, which is productivity growth.
Megan, it's funny to me because so much of the conversation about budget deficits over the last 10 years or so has either been about these issues sort of, you know, are we spending more than we can afford? Are we putting too much on a credit card? Or they're about, has the government taken on so much debt that it increases the risk of some sort of catastrophic financial crisis? We've not in a long time really worried about this issue of capacity and crowd out, basically, where if the government goes and borrows a lot of money, that makes it harder for other people who want to borrow money for good purposes to do so, and it pushes up interest rates. It feels like that maybe it's time for that to come back in the conversation.
Yeah, it's really interesting, right? Because that was the conversation under the Clinton administration, early in the Clinton administration, where you actually had sort of center-left economists coming in and saying, look, interest rates are going up, you're crowding out private investment, and it's time to get the budget in balance so that the capital that is in the economy can go to something other than government spending. And I think that under Obama, you saw an enormous increase in the total stock of debt and the relationship of debt to GDP. And given that Trump has come in under, you know, the tail end of a long expansion, I don't know that it's the tail end. Maybe it'll go on for another 10 years. Doesn't seem likely to be. But, you know, this is a time when you retrench. You try to get the fisc in shape for inevitably some other recession's going to arrive, and you want to be in a position to, when you need to, for emergency spending of some sort, to be able to go out and get that money. And instead, Republicans have basically done this big tax cut. Now, look, I'm basically right leaning. I love, you know, smaller government and tax cuts, but you have to spend as to tax. And if you're not willing to cut the spending, you haven't really cut the taxes. It just means that someone else is going to have to front that money in the future. And that is something where I think, you know, Republicans have lost any whatever residual claim they had to the party of fiscal responsibility. The last year has basically sort of put the lie to that. And I think it's really dangerous, given that we are now coming into the point where we really need to be thinking about how we're going to pay for baby boomer retirements and baby boomer health care and the other growing needs of the nation on the entitlements we already have. Instead of doing that, instead of trying to cut a kind of Simpson-Bowles grand bargain, they've just handed the money back to taxpayers and said, I guess we'll figure out the part where we bring all of this into balance together. And that is going to put pressure on markets, I think. And I think that's one of the things you saw this week.
So where I take this, Josh, is in a different direction. You know, as the economy nears full employment, wages are increasing, suggesting that the long post-2008 economic recovery is reaching a new stage. It's good that wages are increasing, but now you have these concerns about, you know, the era of easy money is over, the inflation dangers. If there's a preemptive war on inflation, it will tamp down any real wage growth. And I think what's often forgotten about the Federal Reserve, and let's not forget there's a new chair, which is also prompting some anxiety, is that the Fed has, as you well know, a dual responsibility and mandate of fostering both highest levels of employment and stable prices. But the Fed governors have decided arbitrarily that steady 2% inflation is the target they hope to sustain. So I come back to the good news. Decent jobs report, top line unemployment remaining at 4.1%, average hourly wages inching up, yet the stock market tanked. Isn't that perverse? I mean, that's part of the nature of a capitalism that is not about putting people first.
Well, so this is the interesting sort of counterintuitive good news story about the stock market decline, that you had this report of this very robust wage growth. You've also seen some of these stories about business expansion. A few weeks ago, United Airlines announced that it would increase capacity, and it caused United and Delta and American, all their stocks tanked because of fear that as they increased capacity, they'd have to cut prices. And so you can tell this story that basically wages are going to go up, prices are going to go down as businesses expand and compete for consumers, and that's going to push down profit margins. So that's bad for stockholders, but it's good for the economy. It's good for ordinary people. Jason, do you find that to be a plausible story, that maybe people should be happy about this market decline?
Yeah, I just don't think we should judge the economy by the stock market. As a direct matter, half of American households don't have money in the stock market, directly or indirectly. And then you see times like there was a stock market correction the end of 2015, beginning of 2016. I remember a lot of people in the White House really nervous about that. I said the stock market, quoting Paul Samuelson, has predicted 10 of the last 4 recessions. My analysis of it was right. And then finally, there's the last point, which you just made and Katrina made, which is often you have good news in the economy, and that's bad for the stock market. The stock market is the present discounted value of the share of the economy that goes to corporate profits. If that share of the economy that goes to corporate profits goes down, the stock market goes down. I think that's a good thing. If the discount rate goes up, you know, that might happen for good reasons as well. So there's a lot of reasons the stock market can move up and down. Some of them are actually because of good news in the economy driving the market down. And then we should care much more about the good news, the higher wages, the lower prices, than we do about the stock market itself.
I also want to talk a little bit about Amazon's search for its second headquarters. Last month, Amazon announced a short list of 20 cities, which is actually not that short a list, where it might eventually employ tens of thousands of workers. And many of the cities and states on the list have been offering up generous incentive packages. Chicago and Illinois, for example, have offered up $1.5 billion in tax breaks and $500 million in infrastructure spending. Maryland's transportation secretary says Amazon will get, quote, a blank check for transport upgrades should they choose to locate in Montgomery County outside Washington, D.C. This has the economist Dean Baker dismayed, saying Amazon is searching for America's stupidest mayor who will overbid by the most for Amazon's presence. He says the research shows government incentives for corporate location decisions generally deliver less in benefits than they cost. Megan, are cities too eager to get Amazon HQ too?
I think in general that these sorts of incentives for corporations are a bad idea. I think in the weird case of Washington, D.C., it's not as bad as it is elsewhere. And here's why. So the Montgomery County example, for one thing. Now, the Washington, D.C. Transit has this bizarre structure where you have a three-state board, which is completely dysfunctional and has systematically underinvested in the transportation that D.C. and its surrounding areas need just to keep moving workers around. So if Maryland gives Amazon a blank check and that actually makes them upgrade, put some money into the kind of completely dysfunctional WMATA system, that would actually be good for Maryland and good for Amazon and good for everyone. Similarly, for the District of Columbia, you've got this weird situation where so many of the big organizations here pay no taxes at all that DC can functionally go to Amazon and be like, look, just pay us a dollar a year. That's more than we're going to get from anyone else who moves into that office space, because it's going to be some nonprofit or it's going to be some government agency. That it's actually weirdly DC is in a position to give huge incentives and still actually literally come out ahead on the deal. That's not true of most cities. In most cases, when you look at the economic research, it turns out that the incentives that are given to corporations to come are basically, they're usually tax incentives and they usually don't do anything for the economy and the corporations aren't even that loyal. But in the case of some of these cities, you have political choke points that are making it very difficult to invest in needed infrastructure. And if that's what people are giving Amazon, then in the case of the District of Columbia, maybe in the case of New York City and a couple of other places, it might not actually be such a bad deal.
There's something kind of shameful, this public bidding war over the location of Amazon's new corporate headquarters. I mean, the, quote, winner essentially looks to be the city or state that's going to offer the most bribe money from their treasury. Josh, we witness, you know, the pious ranting against giving a few bucks worth of jobless benefits to the needy. Then we're witnessing people turn around and shove billions of our tax dollars into corporate welfare for Amazon. There is an interesting group called Our Neighborhoods, Our Future. They've published an open letter to Bezos, head of Amazon. Think of it as a people's RFP, demanding Amazon instead make concessions for arriving. I mean, you know, get some community benefits and not give what may well be negative tax breaks to Amazon.
Jason, what do you make of the argument that you get from a lot of these officials that basically Amazon would be such a big player that it allows you to build a tech cluster around it? So you give out these incentives and it doesn't just get you the Amazon jobs and the Amazon investment, but that it sort of builds an industrial sector around them that you don't have to give the same incentives to, and so it can pay off for the city.
Yeah. So I recently signed a letter saying states and localities shouldn't be offering special deals to Amazon. Mm-hmm. A lot of economists from across the political spectrum signed that letter, and I think there's broad agreement on that. From the perspective of the country as a whole, it's obviously zero sum because the Amazon headquarters is going to end up somewhere in the United States, although maybe I think Toronto might have been on their list. But for the most part, it's going to end up in the United States. Then from the perspective of any city, you have to worry about two things. Amazon has a really long time horizon. They are assessing this deal on the present discounted value of their profits over 20, 30 years. They're really sophisticated about doing that calculations. Mayors and governors have really short time horizons. And when a business with a long time horizon is negotiating with a political authority with a short time horizon, mm-hmm. that's a recipe for taxpayers being ripped off. And then second, this, even if they both were sophisticated, there's something called the winner's curse, which is whoever wins in the auction is the one who made the mistake of paying too much for the item and ends up losing money as a result. And there's a certain amount of that dynamic here. And the last point would be, in addition to bring value, Amazon brings some costs. It brings, for example, additional congestion. Are you going to tax Amazon for the negative externalities that it imposes on others when traffic goes up and schools get more crowded? I wouldn't necessarily advocate that, but you want to take that idea just as seriously as the idea of bribing them to come to your area.
We've reached that time once again for our famed left, right, and center rants featuring pet peeves from across the political spectrum. Megan McArdle, it's your soapbox.
Ross Douthat, New York Times columnist, has been embattled because he wrote that maybe Stephen Miller, who is White House advisor and a pretty strong immigration restrictionist, should be at the table when negotiating on what the shape of a final immigration deal is going to be. For this, he was called a white supremacist, as was the New York Times. As Nick Confessori pointed out on Twitter, it would be odd for the New York Times to be the first white supremacist paper owned by Jews, and and run by a black man. But beyond that, this attempt to delegitimize the idea that maybe we could have fewer immigrants as inherently racist, as inherently not just bad, but worthy of being shunned from the political debate, it's not healthy for American society, and it's probably not going to work given that they won the last election.
Katrina Vandenhoevel, what's your rant?
You know, I'm no longer surprised by anything President Trump says, including his bizarre insistence that those who failed to applaud a State of the Union address were treasonous. It seems obvious that this incurious political novice never watched the annual presentations of his predecessors, during which those not in the president's party often sat glumly without applauding. So President Trump proves day after day that the only thing that seems to really matter to him is his own fragile ego.
Jason Furman, what's on your mind?
You know, I'm going to keep my rant of the week a little bit more concise than Leader Pelosi did her rant of the week, but it's exactly the same. I think that biggest issue going on in our country is the Dreamers. There's a lot of problems and difficulties in the world, like the situation in North Korea that I don't know exactly how to solve. This is a problem that we invented for ourselves. It's a fake deadline. It's a fake problem. We shouldn't have been in the situation in the first place. Now that we are, Congress should pass a way to deal with it. There's clearly a bipartisan approach to doing that in the Senate, and it still hasn't happened.
For my rant, Omarosa Manigault is now a contestant on Celebrity Big Brother, and she had a heart-to-heart with her opponents this week about how hard it was for her to work in Donald Trump's administration, and how she lived in terror of what he was going to tweet, and how she would never vote for him again in a million years. Don't assume that Omarosa and Trump are broken up forever. As the White House spokesman Raj Shah pointed out from the podium of the White House press room this week, the president has now hired and fired Omarosa four times. A fifth time is always possible. But I'm glad that for now Omarosa is back where she belongs, on reality television. And I think she should seriously consider making the rest of her career there. Who wouldn't watch Omarosa Manigault Ice Road Trucker? She could get a house flipping show with Richard Hatch or learn to bake elaborate cakes with The Situation. I, for one, would set my DVR. That's all we have time for today. I want to thank Megan McArdle, Katrina Vandenhoevel, Christopher Green, and Jason Furman. Sarah Fay produced today's program. Our technical director is JC Swadek. Katie Burskins and Colin Cab Washington are our production assistants. Todd M. Simon composed our theme music. I'm Josh Barrow. Thanks for joining us, and tune in next week for more Left, Right, and Center.
Download and subscribe at kcrw.com/LRC, the KCRW app, or wherever you find podcasts. Left, Right, and Center is produced and distributed by KCRW.